Anarchist Council, who is the greatest man in Europe. What is his name? Asked Syme. You would not know it, answered Gregory. That is his greatness. Caesar and Napoleon put all their genius into being heard of, and they were heard of. He puts all his genius into not being heard of, and he is not heard of. But you cannot be for 5 minutes in the room with him without feeling that Caesar and Napoleon would have been children in his hands. He was silent and even pale for a moment and then resumed. But whenever he gives advice, it is always something as startling as an epigram, and yet as practical as the Bank of England. I said to him, what disguise will hide me from the world? What can I find more respectable than bishops and majors? He looked at me with his large but undecipherable face. You want a safe disguise, do you? You want a dress which will guarantee you harmless? A dress in which no one would ever look for a bomb? I nodded. He suddenly lifted his lion's voice. Why, then, dress up as an anarchist, you fool, he roared so that the room shook. Nobody will ever expect you to do anything dangerous then. And he turned his broad back on me without another word. I took his advice and have never regretted it. I preached blood and murder to those women day and night, and, by God, they would let me wield their perambulators. Syme sat watching him with some respect in his large blue eyes. You took me in, he said. It is really a smart dodge. Then, after a pause, he added, what do you call this tremendous president of yours? We generally call him Sunday, replied Gregory with simplicity. You see, there are 7 members of the Central Anarchist Council, and they are named after days of the week. He is called Sunday by some of his admirers, Bloody Sunday. It is curious you should mention the matter, because the very night you have dropped in, if I may so express it, is the night on which our London branch, which assembles in this room, has to elect its own deputy to fill a vacancy in the council. The gentleman who has for some time past played, with propriety and general applause, the difficult part of Thursday, has died quite suddenly. Consequently, we have called a meeting this very evening to elect a successor. He got to his feet and strolled across the room with a sort of smiling embarrassment. I feel somehow as if you were my mother, Syme, he continued casually. I feel that I can confide anything to you, as you have promised to tell nobody. In fact, I will confide to you something that I would not say in so many words to the anarchists who will be coming to the room in about 10 minutes. We shall, of course, go through a form of election, but I don't mind telling you that it's practically certain what the result will be. He looked down for a moment modestly. It is almost a settled thing that I am to be Thursday. My dear fellow, said Syme heartily, I congratulate you. A great career. Gregory smiled in deprecation and walked across the room talking rapidly. As a matter of fact, everything is ready for me on this table, he said, and the ceremony will probably be the shortest possible. Syme also strolled across to the table and found lying across it a walking stick, which turned out on examination to be a sword stick, a large Colt's revolver, a sandwich case, and a formidable flask of brandy. Over the chair beside the table was thrown a heavy-looking cape or cloak. I have only to get the form of election finished, continued Gregory with animation. Then I snatch up this cloak and stick, stuff these other things into my pocket, step out of the door in this cavern which opens on the river, where there is a steam tug waiting for me, and then, oh, the wild joy of being Thursday. And he clasped his hands. Syme, who had sat down once more with his usual insolent languor, got to his feet with an unusual air of hesitation. Why is it, he asked vaguely, that I think you are quite a decent fellow? Why do I positively like you, Gregory? He paused a moment and then added with a sort of fresh curiosity, is it because you are such an ass? There was a thoughtful silence again, and then he cried out, well, damn it all, this is the funniest situation I have ever been in my life, and I am going to act accordingly. Gregory, I gave you a promise before I came into this place. That promise I would keep under red-hot pincers. Would you give me, for my own safety, a little promise of the same kind?
A promise? Asked Gregory, wondering.
Yes, said Syme very seriously, a promise. I swore before God that I would not tell your secret to the police.
Will you swear by humanity, or whatever beastly thing you believe in, that you will not tell my secret to the anarchists?
Your secret? Asked the staring Gregory.
Have you got a secret?
Yes, said Syme, I have a secret.
Then after a pause, will you swear?
Gregory glared at him gravely for a few moments and then said abruptly, You must have bewitched me, but I feel furious curiosity about you. Yes, I will swear not to tell the anarchists anything you tell me. But look sharp, for they will be here in a couple of minutes.
Syme slowly rose to his feet and thrust his long white hands into his long gray trouser pockets. Almost as he did so, there came five knocks on the outer grating, proclaiming the arrival of the first of the conspirators.
Well, said Syme slowly, I don't know how to tell you the truth more shortly than by saying that your expedient of dressing up as an aimless poet is not confined to you or your president. We have known the dodge for some time at Scotland Yard.
Gregory tried to spring up straight, but he swayed thrice.
What do you say? He asked in an inhuman voice.
Yes, said Syme simply, I am a police detective, but I think I hear your friends coming.
From the doorway there came a murmur of, Mr. Joseph Chamberlain. It was repeated twice and thrice, and then 30 times, and the crowd of Joseph Chamberlains, a solemn thought, could be heard trampling down the corridor. Chapter 3. The Man Who Was Thursday. Before one of the fresh faces could appear at the doorway, Gregory's stunned surprise had fallen from him. He was beside the table with a bound and a noise in his throat like a wild beast. He caught up the Colt's revolver and took aim at Syme. Syme did not flinch, but he put up a pale and polite hand.
Don't be such a silly man, he said, with the effeminate dignity of a curate.
Don't you see it's not necessary? Don't you see that we're both in the same boat?
Yes, and jolly seasick.
Gregory could not speak, but he could not fire either, and he looked his question.
Don't you see we've checkmated each other? Cried Syme.
I can't tell the police you are an anarchist.
You can't tell the anarchists I'm a policeman.
I can only watch you, knowing what you are. You can only watch me, knowing what I am. In short, it's a lonely intellectual duel, my head against yours.
I'm a policeman deprived of the help of the police. You, my poor fellow, are an anarchist deprived of the help of that law and organization which is so essential to anarchy. The one solitary difference is in your favor. You are not surrounded by inquisitive policemen. I am surrounded by inquisitive anarchists. I cannot betray you, but I might betray myself. Come, come, wait and see me betray myself. I shall do it so nicely.
Gregory put the pistol slowly down, still staring at Syme as if he were a sea monster.
I don't believe in immortality, he said at last, but if, after all this, you were to break your word, God would make a hell only for you to howl in forever.
I shall not break my word, said Syme sternly, nor will you break yours. Here are your friends. The mass of the anarchists entered the room heavily with a slouching and somewhat weary gait. But one little man, with a black beard and glasses, a man somewhat of the type of Mr. Tim Healy, detached himself and bustled forward with some papers in his hand.
Comrade Gregory, he said, I suppose this man is a delegate?
Gregory, taken by surprise, looked down and muttered the name of Syme, but Syme replied almost pertly, I am glad to see that your gate is well enough guarded to make it hard for anyone to be here who was not a delegate. The brow of the little man with the black beard was, however, still contracted with something like suspicion.
What branch do you represent? He asked sharply.
I should hardly call it a branch, said Syme, laughing. I should call it, at the very least, a root.
What do you mean?
The fact is, said Syme serenely, the truth is I am a Sabbatarian. I have been specially sent here to see that you show a due observance of Sunday.
The little man dropped one of his papers, and a flicker of fear went over all the faces of the group. Evidently, the awful president, whose name was Sunday, did sometimes send down such irregular ambassadors to such branch meetings. "Well, comrade," said the man with the papers after a pause, "I suppose we'd better give you a seat in the meeting." "If you ask my advice as a friend," said Syme with severe benevolence, "I think you'd better." When Gregory heard the dangerous dialogue end with a sudden safety for his rival, he rose abruptly and paced the floor in painful thought. He was indeed in an agony of diplomacy. It was clear that Syme's inspired impudence was likely to bring him out of all merely accidental dilemmas. Little was to be hoped from them. He could not himself betray Syme, partly from honor, but partly also because, if he betrayed him, and for some reason failed to destroy him, the Syme who escaped would be a Syme freed from all obligation of secrecy, a Syme who would simply walk to the nearest police station. After all, it was only one night's discussion, and only one detective who would know of it. He would let out as little as possible of their plans that night, and then let Syme go, and chance it. He strode across to the group of anarchists, which was already distributing itself along the benches. "I think it is time we began," he said. "This steam tug is waiting on the river already. I move that Comrade Buttons takes the chair." This being approved by a show of hands, the little man with the paper slipped into the presidential seat. "Comrades," he began, as sharp as a pistol shot, "our meeting tonight is important, though it need not be long. This branch has always had the honor of electing Thursdays for the Central European Council. We have elected many and splendid Thursdays. We all lament the sad decease of the heroic worker who occupied the post until last week. As you know, his services to the cause were considerable. He organized the great dynamite coup of Brighton, which, under happier circumstances, ought to have killed everybody on the pier. As you also know, his death was as self-denying as his life, for he died through his faith in a hygienic mixture of chalk and water as a substitute for milk, which beverage he regarded as barbaric, and as involving cruelty to the cow. Cruelty, or anything approaching to cruelty, revolted him always. But it is not to acclaim his virtues that we are met, but for a harder task. It is difficult properly to praise his qualities, but it is more difficult to replace them. Upon you, comrades, it devolves this evening to choose out of the company present the man who shall be Thursday. If any comrade suggests a name, I will put it to the vote. If no comrade suggests a name, I can only tell myself that that near dynamiter who has gone from us has carried into the unknowable abyss the last secret of his virtue and his innocence. There was a stir of almost inaudible applause, such as is sometimes heard in church. Then a large old man with a long and venerable white beard, perhaps the only real working man present, rose lumberingly and said, "I move that Comrade Gregory be elected Thursday," and sat lumberingly down again. "Does anyone second?" asked the chairman. A little man with a velvet coat and pointed beard seconded. "Before I put the matter to the vote," said the chairman, "I will call on Comrade Gregory to make a statement." Gregory rose amid a great rumble of applause. His face was deadly pale, so that by contrast his queer red hair looked almost scarlet. But he was smiling and altogether at ease. He had made up his mind, and he saw his best policy quite plain in front of him, like a white road. His best chance was to make a softened and ambiguous speech, such as would leave on the detective's mind the impression that the anarchist brotherhood was a very mild affair after all. He believed in his own literary power, his capacity for suggesting fine shades and picking perfect words. He thought that with care he could succeed, in spite of all the people around him, in conveying an impression of the institution, subtly and delicately false. Syme had once thought that anarchists, under all their bravado, were only playing the fool. Could he not now, in the hour of peril, make Syme think so again? Comrades, began Gregory in a low but penetrating voice, it is not necessary for me to tell you what is my policy, for it is your policy also. Our belief has been slandered. It has been disfigured. It has been utterly confused and concealed, but it has never been altered. Those who talk about anarchism and its dangers go everywhere and anywhere to get their information, except to us, except to the Fountainhead. They learn about anarchists from sixpenny novels. They learn about anarchists from tradesmen's newspapers. They learn about anarchists from Alley Sloper's Half Holiday and the Sporting Times. They never learn about anarchists from anarchists. We have no chance of denying the mountainous slanders which are heaped upon our heads from one end of Europe to another. The man who has always heard that we are walking plagues has never heard our reply. I know that he will not hear it tonight, though my passion were to rend the roof. For it is deep, deep under the earth that the persecuted are permitted to assemble, as the Christians assembled in the catacombs. But if, by some credible accident, there were here tonight a man who all his life had thus immensely misunderstood us, I would put this question to him. When those Christians met in those catacombs, what sort of moral reputation had they in the streets above? What tales were told of their atrocities by one educated Roman to another? Suppose, I would say to him, suppose that we are only repeating that still mysterious paradox of history. Suppose we seem as shocking as the Christians because we are really as harmless as the Christians. Suppose we seem as mad as the Christians because we are really as meek. The applause that had greeted the opening sentences had been gradually growing fainter, and at the last word it stopped suddenly. In the abrupt silence, the man with the velvet jacket said in a high, squeaky voice, I am not meek. Comrade Witherspoon tells us, resumed Gregory, that he is not meek. Ah, how little he knows himself. His words are indeed extravagant, his appearance is ferocious, and even to an ordinary taste, unattractive. But only the eye of a friendship as deep and delicate as mine can perceive the deep foundation of solid meekness which lies at the base of him, too deep even for himself to see. I repeat, we are the true early Christians, only that we come too late. We are simple as they revere simple. Look at Comrade Witherspoon. We are modest as they were modest. Look at me. We are merciful. No, no, cried out Mr. Witherspoon with the velvet jacket. I say we are merciful, repeated Gregory furiously, as the early Christians were merciful. Yet this did not prevent their being accused of eating human flesh. We do not eat human flesh. Shame, cried Witherspoon. Why not? Comrade Witherspoon, said Gregory with a feverish gaiety, is anxious to know why nobody eats him. Laughter. In our society, at any rate, which loves him sincerely, which is founded upon love. No, no, said Witherspoon, down with love. Which is founded upon love, repeated Gregory, grinding his teeth, there will be no difficulty about the aims which we shall pursue as a body, or which I should pursue were I chosen as the representative of that body. Superbly careless of the slanders that represent us as assassins and enemies of human society, we shall pursue with moral courage and quiet intellectual pressure the permanent ideals of brotherhood and simplicity. Gregory resumed his seat and passed his hand across his forehead. The silence was sudden and awkward, but the chairman rose like an automaton and said in a colorless voice, Does anyone oppose the election of Comrade Gregory? The assembly seemed vague and subconsciously disappointed, and Comrade Witherspoon moved restlessly on his seat and muttered in his thick beard. By the sheer rush of routine, however, the motion would have been put and carried, but as the chairman was opening his mouth to put it, Syme sprang to his feet and said in a small and quiet voice, Yes, Mr. Chairman, I oppose. The most effective fact in oratory is an unexpected change in the voice. Mr. Gabriel Syme evidently understood oratory. Having said these first formal words in a moderated tone and with a brief simplicity, he made his next word ring and volley in the vault as if one of the guns had gone off. "Comrades," he cried in a voice that made every man jump out of his boots, "have we come here for this? Do we live underground like rats in order to listen to talk like this? This is talk we might listen to while eating buns on a sunny school treat.